This is The Full Spectrum. The show provides a wide range of news and competing opinions. The commentaries, beliefs, and viewpoints expressed by segment hosts and guests do not necessarily represent those of WJSU-FM, Jackson State University, or its administrators. The content of this program is for informational and/or entertainment value only and not meant as an endorsement or recommendation in lieu of professional guidance on relevant topics.
It's the full spectrum. It's the full spectrum. We got news,
entertainment,
interviews, and so much more. It's the full spectrum.
On today's show, MDOT Commissioner Dick Hall talks about fixing Mississippi's roads and bridges. The co-founder of the Emmett Till Interpretive Center talks about the continuing vandalism of Emmett Till historical markers in the state. And we hear from the author of Talking Across the Divide. Welcome to The Full Spectrum for Tuesday, August 14th. I'm your host, Dwayne Doty. The Mississippi Department of Transportation for Commissioner for the Central District, Dick Hall, is growing more frustrated at the fact that not enough is being done to fix the state's roads and bridges. I spoke with Commissioner Hall about the issue and what he'd like to see happen. Before we go any further, could you give me an overall status report on the roads and bridges in Mississippi, maybe an overall grade, and how much work needs to be done?
Well, it's a system of highways that not too many years ago was ranked the sixth best in the United States, number one in the Mid-South, and the latest ranking I've seen on that is we're now listed 41st best in the nation. We got over 1,000 deficient bridges, and we got 5,000 lane miles of badly deteriorated highways, and all that needs about $4 billion to fix.
Wow. So let's say that we had that $4 billion. There were no financial problems in the state. How long under those conditions would it take to do all the work that needs to be done?
Oh, it takes years. I mean, that's one of the problems. If you don't have stable funding, you know, between the time you conceive to construct a major highway project, like it's adding lanes or building a new highway or so forth, it takes five to eight to nine years. And you've got to be able to correctly predict the money you're going to have to be able to pay for that, something that's spread over that long. So you needed a finite, definitive, stable source of money, and that's why I keep getting back to the way it's been done in the past, is the fuel tax. It's a user pays tax. The person using the highway pays it. We don't take the sales tax you're paying on groceries or other things and use that to fund highways. And over 20 states have increased their fuel, have adjusted their fuel tax in the last three or four years.
Well, that's where we seem to be right now. Not if this needs to be done, but how it would be done. The gas tax is one of the ideas, a lottery. The lieutenant governor proposed diverting any leftover money at the end of the year into a fund for roads and bridges as opposed to into the rainy day fund. You didn't like that plan. Why not?
What could be less dependable than Mississippi having a surplus of money at the end of a fiscal year? That's happened about one or two times in the last five or six. Once again, we've got to have some dependable source of money. If the lottery, fine, the lottery, the biggest number I've seen that projected, if that's something like $80 million a year, I'm talking $300 or $400 million a year. And when I speak of a fuel tax, I'm not suggesting we go up 10 cents overnight like Exxon does. I'm suggesting a 2 to 3 cents a gallon per year for a determined number of years, a very menial increase each year until we've got back to stable funding. That hasn't been adjusted in 31 years. You'd think anything, any funding that's 31 years old is outdated. Now, of course, other things have been suggested, such as now that we're going to be able to collect sales tax on internet sales. That's nobody knows exactly how much money that's going to be, and yes, that certainly would be helpful. But the state and federal system that the Mississippi Department of Transportation is responsible for is only part of the problem. You also got local government have the same problems. All these bridges that have recently been closed in Mississippi were county bridges. So it's a problem for counties, for municipalities, and certainly the state and federal system.
So let's break this into two parts here, because it seems one issue is how it would be funded. We discussed some of those. But it seems to me, from what I'm reading, Commissioner Hall, that the other issue would be who would control the money. So talk to me about that issue.
Well, that is one that's going to come up. People say, we're the only state that has an elected transportation commission. That's right. We're the only state where Joe Sixpack can pick up the phone and call his commissioner and discuss some problem with him. What the lieutenant governor has suggested is doing away with people voting on commissioners and turn it all over to the governor. And then I want to see you try to pick up that phone and get the governor's attention. And like Louisiana, where they have that, it's under the control of the governor, and the governor decides where and when certain highways are going to be built. And they're going to be built in the neighborhood of his supporters. That's the way it works. We have it equally divided around the state. We have three different districts with elected commissioner in each district, and each one of those commissioners is fighting for funds for his particular district. I think it works extremely well. You're able to be responsive to the public, and you also are able to work together to accomplish something. It works well when you've got the money to do it. Now, when you don't have the money to fix what's broken, then obviously somebody's looking to shoot somebody, and they usually want to shoot the messenger. And I happen to be the messenger. I'm the one that says, it is broken, and we need to do something to fix it, and it's not going to be something little. This is a big problem, a big problem.
Tell our listeners how these many, many projects, hundreds, thousands of projects, how are they ranked in order of importance right now?
Well, when it comes to the federal system particularly, we are mandated by the federal government to spend my first monies on where most of the traffic is. And we don't have enough money to get out there and do some of the things that desperately need to be done in some of the more rural areas of the state. We don't have enough money to take care of where all the traffic is. So the only answer is to make the pie bigger. We've got to figure out a way to provide the money to statewide to take care of all these problems. This 1,000 deficient bridges and 5,000 lane miles of bad highways is spread all over the state of Mississippi, in the rural areas and the urban areas.
I've heard different things, but you would probably know better than me. What impact is this having, especially on businesses in the state, that they're having trouble transporting goods sometimes because of the roadways?
I am so glad you asked that question. Let me tell you maybe more than you want to know. Mississippi's GDP has grown just 3.4% compared to a national average of 17% since 2008. And our neighboring states, they've grown over 10%. Now, I was only 3.4%. We have the highest out-migration rate in the nation for people younger than 40 with a college degree. We had 10,000 people leave the state of Mississippi between July 2016 and 2017 trying to find work. And you say, well, what does that got to do with transportation? Absolutely everything. If you don't have a modern intermodal system of transportation, business is not going to come locate in your state. That they're not coming. That is on a criteria list right at the top or very top of every list somebody that a prospective industry has when they're thinking about putting facilities in your state. And we're falling further and further behind. And those are real numbers. That's not something I dreamed up. Those are factual numbers, and we're getting farther and farther behind.
Since we're talking about a lottery here, if you had to bet, Commissioner Hall, what are the chances we're going to get this special session?
Well, I think you have a special session, and I think something will probably be agreed to for some assistance to local government. I'm going to be very surprised and extremely disappointed if the legislature does not fund your state and federal system, but I'm fearful about it. I really am. And they say, well, it's a re-election year. It's going to be a re-election year next year. It was a re-election year in 1987, the last time we adjusted the fuel tax, and not a single member of the legislature got beat because of it. But for some reason, I can't seem to get the some of the leadership of the legislature to focus on this as something that really is a serious problem and some serious action needs to be taken. I hope I'm wrong. I hope they come in and fund it all. I'll be pleasantly surprised if they do.
And before I let you go, what kind of support is there in the legislature to raise the gas tax?
Of course, mixed. There's some people that signed a pledge before they even ran for office that they were not going to vote for any kind of a thing that even looked like a tax increase of any kind, no matter what the problem is. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me why you do that. But anyway, there are those that did. But I guess a lot of support from a number, of course, particularly the House. The House of Representatives, the leadership of the House, has been very supportive of trying to do something, and they've offered a number of issues. The Senate has not been that supportive. But I tell you, who is supportive is the John Q. Public out there. They're the ones driving, trying to dodge the potholes, and they're the ones that want something done. But the situation is that they have to depend on an elected legislature, and that's where the money is, that's where the control of the money is, and that's where the solution lies.
Well, Transportation Commissioner Dick Hall for the Central District of Mississippi, I'll be calling you after that special session to get your feedback.
I hope we've got something really pleasing to report.
We've got to take a break. When we come back, a conversation with the co-founder of the Emmett Till Interpretive Center. Stick around.
Support for WJSU comes from the Mississippi Link. Each week, the Link has connected, integrated, and communicated urban, rural, and community news from around the globe to people of Mississippi and beyond. And now its website provides daily news and events at MississippiLink.net. Welcome to your world.
Welcome back to The Full Spectrum on Cool and Current WJSU. I'm your host, Dwayne Doty. Just last month, a historical marker honoring Emmett Till, the 14-year-old boy who was lynched and dumped in the Tallahatchie River, was shot up yet again. I spoke earlier today with Patrick Weems, who's a co-founder of the Emmett Till Interpretive Center in Sumner, Mississippi. Talk to me about what's been going on there. This latest shooting happened in July. Kind of give us a little history and how you're feeling about this ongoing vandalism.
Yeah, so our organization started when the community finally came together, black and white, to offer an apology to the Emmett Till family that basically said that racial reconciliation begins by telling the truth. And so as part of that process, that truth-telling process, we marked about 8 sites throughout the county that would tell the story of Emmett Till. Unfortunately, from day one, we've had to deal with vandalism. And it got so bad that one of our markers at the river site was shot up so many times you couldn't even read what was on the sign. And we decided to replace it, largely because of folks from around the country started a crowdfunder and wanted to see the sign replaced. And we invited the Till family down from Chicago to help dedicate a new marker. And we were so excited to finally see it restored and replaced. And then within a month, we came back and it was already vandalized. And just a real defeating moment, sad moment, but we've already seen an outpouring of love of people from around the country who've offered to help. So we're not giving up.
you said there's several of these markers. Has the vandalism been occurring at all of them, or has the vandalism only been occurring at what's called the river site, which is the actual location where Emmett Till's body was removed from the river?
Yeah, exactly. We've seen it all over. The first ever marker that mentioned Emmett Till's name was a highway marker, and that was put up in 2005. And once that was put up, immediately somebody wrote KKK on it. So it's not just the river site, although I think the river site gets the brunt of it because of its rural location. It's down a two-mile gravel road and kind of a desolate area. And so I think it's more prime for vandals to go out there.
Talk to me about what's happening now in terms of these incidents. What are authorities doing, and are you satisfied from what you're hearing from authorities, and which law enforcement agencies are involved?
Yeah, currently it's just the Tallahatchie County Sheriff's Department, and unfortunately we just lost our sheriff. I believe, under indictment for some other unrelated charges. So as soon as we get a new sheriff, we hope that person will take it seriously and help us. We do have a small amount of information that we've given over to the sheriff's department. But we also, we think that there's a potential to escalate it. But at this point, we're cautiously optimistic that something can be done.
This would be disturbing under any circumstances, but given the tensions in the country right now, the racial divide that seems to be growing, it could be frightening for some people, especially people living close to the marker in that area. So talk to me about, and complicating matters even more, when something like this happens, it could be simply teenagers being teenagers, or it could be someone with real racial animus. So tell me how things are there at the Interpretive Center right now, how the folks that work there are reacting, and people in the community.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a chance to talk to some of the local community members who live within a mile of the sign, and I think they're just frustrated, that someone, even if it was out of ignorance and not necessarily hatred, even if it's just ignorance, it's just so disrespectful, right, that we don't respect, the site where a 14-year-old was killed, that we can't even respect a sign that acknowledges his martyrdom. I think we have a continued resolve and understanding that racism is not going to go away, right, overnight, that this type of work is going to be generational. And while I think there is people that want to divide, by and large, our community is steadfast in seeing these signs put up 10 years ago, and they remain steadfast. And that's support from local mayors to the board of supervisors of the county down to our 18-person board. That are all committed to seeing this work continue.
A lot of our listeners are familiar with Emmett Till's story, what happened to him when he came down here from Chicago, but many people may not be familiar with the Emmett Till Interpretive Center and what you do there. Why don't you fill folks in?
Yeah, absolutely. So our center is located directly across the street from the Sumner Courthouse, and in 1955 is where J.W. Milam and Roy Bryant were able to get off on murder charges, despite overwhelming evidence, despite their admission that they kidnapped Emmett Till. The jury decided not to indict these two murderers. 4 months later, the men confessed to murdering Emmett Till, and there was a cloud that held over our community. And it wasn't until 50 years later that the community started to have conversations, and they acknowledged that the first step in order to break the silence that had been in our community, that they needed to apologize to the Till family. So out of that apology, the community raised over $3 million to restore the courthouse back to the way it looked in 1955. So when you come to our town, the setting is exactly the way it would look in 55. you walk into the courtroom, you can see exactly where Mose Wright, Emmett Till's uncle, stood and gave testimony. And then across the street, our interpretive center works to live that apology out, right? It wasn't enough for it just to be words on a piece of paper. So we have youth programs. We have readings of the trial transcript once a year. So we do programs that kind of live that out.
Finally, I want to ask for your reaction to the decision by the Justice Department to reopen its investigation into the Emmett Till case. They say they've discovered new information. Tell me how that's affecting the work you do there and how you feel about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're committed to seeing where the truth takes us. Carolyn Bryant, the woman who had the interaction with Emmett Till in 1955 at the Bryant's Grocery, her testimony in 1955 was that Emmett jumped across the counter, grabbed her, and said, you know, some vile comments. And she just now recanted that story, right? And so that gave us a moment to kind of reflect on how her version of events as a privileged white woman was truth. Right, it was truth in 1955, and it held truth in a lot of people's eyes. The FBI is looking at that, along with other new information that has emerged, to see if there's a potential to bring an investigation against Carolyn Bryant. And while you know many would say, you know, oh, this is an old woman, you know, blah blah blah. Our sense is that we're never too late for justice. If she was involved in the murder in any type of way. We need to support our local DA and FBI to make sure that comes down. And I think the interesting thing is that it gives us a moment to reflect, right? It's not about just putting an old person behind bars, but it's to reflect on that system of racism that existed in 1955 and how do those systems still exist today and what larger work can we do today to make sure that this sort of thing never happens again?
Well said. Patrick Weems, co-founder of the Emmett Till Interpretive Center, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
We've got to take another break. We'll hear from the author of the book Talking Across the Divide when we come back.
Support of this program is made in part by From sore throats and fevers to annual wellness visits and more specialized care, Merit Health Medical Group has you covered with more than 30 primary care and specialty practices across the Jackson and Vicksburg metropolitan areas. Merit Health Medical Group providers offer care with your schedule in mind. Walk-ins are welcome at all primary care practices. Same day or next day appointments are available at 844-MS-MERIT. That's 844-MS-MERIT, because there's merit in convenient care.
Welcome back to The Full Spectrum on Cool and Current WJSU. I'm your host, Dwayne Doty. Talking Across the Divide, How to Communicate with People You Disagree With and May Even Change the World, is out in paperback this month. I spoke earlier today with author Justin Lee. So the paperback version of the book is out this month, and to say that it's timely is an understatement. Talk to me about why you wrote the book in the first place.
I have been frustrated, as I think many of us have been, with the level of discourse in the country. I mean, we're so polarized right now on political issues, on social issues. You know, it's like we can't even talk, sometimes even to members of our own family, about the issues that we care about. And I had already spent the last 20 years of my life dealing with controversial issues and bringing people together. I have done a lot of work on LGBT issues in Christian spaces, which of course is hugely controversial. And so I'm used to talking to people on different sides of an issue where people say, look, there's a line in the sand here. This is what is right. That's what's wrong. And yet somehow needing to be able to talk to the people they disagree with. And I thought, gosh, I've learned a lot of lessons about how to do that on one issue What would that look like on all of the other issues that divide us in society? And so I started working on talking across the divide.
And what's the biggest lesson you've learned?
Well, gosh, there are a lot of them.
That's a loaded question, I know, but it just popped into my head because you could pick a couple of issues, but race has got to be in the running for being one of the most divisive issues affecting the country right now. And so when I ask you what's the biggest lesson you learn, I guess I'm trying to see where do you start when you try to bridge that divide?
You know, in the book, I talk about some of the big barriers that keep us from being able to be heard by people on the other side of issues and how to overcome those barriers. And one of the things that I talk about in the book that is a very powerful tool for getting people to listen to you is to listen to them first. And we can understand that intellectually, that like when you listen to someone, it makes them more likely to listen to you, and that you can learn a lot by listening to somebody about what they believe that may be wrong and what's motivating them and, you know, all kinds of helpful things. So intellectually, you know, I think people understand that. But emotionally, that is so difficult, particularly when you're talking about issues where you feel like somebody else's side has already been heard enough, and it's your side that hasn't been heard, and it's your voice that's been silenced. And you think, why should I have to listen to this person when this person is the one who needs to shut up and listen to me? And you may be right. The other person may need to shut up and listen to you, but what's effective is not always what's fair. And one of the things I find is that when you can sit down with somebody one-on-one and listen to them, even if they're the one with all the power, and make sure that they actually feel heard and understood by you, it does so much to get them into a space where they are able to finally listen to you. And so often we have to shoulder this burden, even that we shouldn't have to shoulder. But if you're willing to do it, you can really, truly change the world.
One of the chapters in the book, which I think is timely, is fighting falsehood. We know there's a narrative ongoing about the fake news. We have a president that many people view as a liar. So you have two sides of this falsehood narrative. Talk to me about that chapter and how pertinent it is to what's happening now.
Well, it's amazing how much difference it makes when someone is not starting from the same set of facts that you are. So, you know, I can't tell you the number of times that I've seen where you've got two people who are arguing over some issue, where if they would just stop and actually recognize that they're starting from two separate sets of facts, they'd realize that they're talking past each other because they think that the situation is different. Maybe even the definition of a term. You've got two people arguing about, for instance, white privilege, and one person doesn't actually know what the other person means by white privilege, and so they're arguing about something that they think is something, you know, they think is something else. But particularly when you're talking about what are the actual facts of a situation that we're facing, what are the actual options that we have, what do the numbers say? It's very difficult to get anywhere in a conversation if you don't agree on what the facts are. And yet, when you just try to correct people by saying, oh, no, you're wrong about the facts, they often don't want to listen. And so there are strategies you can use, for instance, sharing personal stories about, like, one person rather than giving facts about a whole group of people that can be more effective sometimes in correcting people's misconceptions about the facts and fighting that, as you said, the fake news.
You know, there are a lot of good concepts in the book. I wonder what have you found when a situation, whether it be what's happening in the country at whole or within a family or a group of friends, when a situation escalates perhaps out of control? If you look at we just passed the anniversary of the march in Charlottesville last year. It's one thing to talk, but during that rally, someone was killed. And a lot of times when things escalate, it's hard to walk that back. You really can't walk that back. The same sorts of escalations, as I said, happen within families. What advice do you have when a situation has gotten so bad people don't even think they can talk to each other?
Well, I think that's the situation on a number of issues in the country right now, and as you said, even within our own families. And I think that very often what happens is the folks who are talking about, you know, oh, we just need to have some dialogue, we just need to talk about stuff, are approaching it from a standpoint of, you know, let's just agree to disagree and let's just kind of all recognize that everybody's got their own opinion and that's okay. And when you're talking about issues where people are being killed, where people's lives and future may be in jeopardy, these kinds of big issues, that's not enough. You can't just say, oh, well, you know, we'll just agree to disagree. Sometimes it matters that we get it right, and it matters that something change. And so the argument that I'm putting forward in this book is that really talking across the divide means more than just saying, oh, let's agree to disagree, you know, there are different opinions on different sides. That's not enough. We need to be able to say, look, I think that you're wrong on this. I think that this matters, and I think we need to change it. We need to get it right. But in order to actually get the other person to be willing to listen, we have to find ways of having dialogue that is strategic, not just dialogue for the sake of dialogue, but strategic dialogue that is working to increase the understanding of the other side so that we can actually get somewhere rather than just spinning our wheels. And that's hard to do, but I think it's absolutely necessary if we're going to resolve some of the issues and the tensions that we're facing right now.
As we said, there are a lot of issues right now to resolve. The name of the book is Talking Across the Divide, How to Communicate with People You Disagree With, and Maybe Even Change the World. Justin Lee, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's our show for today. Don't forget to catch Metro Morning Live with Rob J tomorrow at 7 and again at 10 on JSU TV, Comcast Channel 14. You can catch their live stream on Facebook. Just type in Jackson State TV, one word. We'll be back tomorrow at 4 with more of the Full Spectrum right here on FM 88.5. You can catch our live stream on WJSU.org. Up next, Latin Jazz with your host, Dale Morris. Have a great evening.